Chapter 46. December 21st of year 18. About 600 meters below us is a plane that could be compared to a steppe, but which gives a completely different impression. In particular, the colors do not resemble those on Earth. The greens look all wrong. I know there are simple physical causes for this. Proxima Centauri radiates most of its energy in wavelengths different from those of the Sun. Photosynthesis, which most of the plants we see below must be utilizing, would be less efficient using the greens of Earth. I somehow feel cheated, almost disgusted, seeing these strange hues that most closely resemble black with shades of greenish shimmer. This makes everything seem artificial, as if a painter had created and colored his personal vision of hell. Adam and Eve are utterly amazed. They are not as biased as I am. "This wide view," Adam says. "I'm in awe of it." "That's nothing compared to looking at infinity from a spaceship." I am surprised at myself for this response. "In space you feel lost so easily," Adam says. "Here I seem small, but not tiny. Not about to dissolve into nothing." "Yes, there's a border, the horizon," Eve says, pointing in a vague direction. "It is like a frame around a painting. I feel I'm part of something larger. In space, I'm only a negligible part of the great nothingness." Adam and Eve have never lived on a planet, but they really feel at ease here. Is this based on human genes? And do I myself feel different because I'm lacking a body? By now, I long for the freedom messenger offered me. Adam, who still has a blanket wrapped around his shoulders after a rest period of 6 hours, is standing near the edge of a cliff. One more step, and he would plummet downward. I want to place my hand on his shoulder, just for safety's sake, but I suppress the urge. Adam is shading his eyes with his hand. The shadow of the mountain reaches far into the plain. The area beyond it glitters brightly, or at least appears to do so. We have quickly become accustomed to the near twilight of Proxima B. "Are you rested enough for the descent?" I ask. Both of them nod, and just like during the climb, we secure ourselves with ropes. The way down will not be as stressful as the ascent, because it is not so hot, and gravity will assist us. On the other hand, we will be climbing in the dark. In the shade, it is about as bright as the night during a full moon on Earth. I'm about to explain this to Adam and Eve when I realize they will not understand the comparison. If they ever reach Earth, which would be impossible, they would compare the moonlit nights there with the shade areas of Proxima B. It is details like these that demonstrate again and again how different the two are from me. The lower we get during our descent, the faster we move. Now and then I have to tell Adam and Eve to slow down. We must not grow careless. A fall from 120 meters is still dangerous, even if you are caught by a rope. Yet I understand they are in a hurry. Down there lies the part of the planet that might become their home for the next 100 years. It is very different from the parched plains we landed on. Adam is the first one down, and I am watching him. First, he looks for a free spot, but when he obviously does not find one, he carefully places his foot on the dense vegetation below him. He waves at us while standing there. "Everything is fine. It doesn't look dangerous," he calls. I hope he is right, but we really have no choice. Eve and I reach the ground simultaneously. My electronic sensors tell me that I sink in by precisely 3.5 centimeters, but otherwise, the ground appears to be stable. I turn around and start examining the plants. Meanwhile, Adam is already moving away from the cliff. I would prefer him to wait for my results, but it makes no sense to call him back. At least Eve is coming back to me. She is holding something in her right hand. "Look, a flower," she says, offering me a stalk with a bell-shaped object at its end. On the outside, it is black, like everything here, but the inside displays colorful stripes, pink, a somewhat dirty yellow, purple, and brown. At the bottom of the bell, there is a small hole, which seems to lead inside the stalk. "That's not a real blossom," I say. "What then?" Eve asks. "I suspect the plant uses it to catch small animals." I carefully touch the inside of the blossom. The colored stripes detach themselves and flip inward. You see, if something crawls in here, it will get scared by the motion and hide inside the hole. Then it is most likely digested there. I look around. There are only a few of these theoretically carnivorous plants. The area below the steep cliff is permanently in shadow, and is dominated by plants with hard, leathery leaves that appear almost black. They are no taller than 5 centimeters, and they cover every square millimeter. But between them stand many of the wind energy-based hair plants we saw earlier. The two species do not seem to be competitors. Perhaps they profit from each other. The leafy plants still get 99% of the remaining light, while the hairs gather energy and moisture at a height that the leafy plants could not easily reach. I try to count their exact distribution, but then I notice that a few of those flowers seem to be growing near us. "Were these here earlier?" I ask, pointing at the plants forming a semicircle around us. "I didn't see them," Eve replies, as she is pointing farther out from the cliff. "I picked that one from over there." I look at the recording made automatically by Jay's visual system. "No, they really weren't here before," I explain. "This means they're moving," she says. "So perhaps they're not plants but animals. But they also have leaves, and certainly use photosynthesis. So we probably have to forget about the life form categories used on Earth." "Did they somehow sense us?" "It looks like it," I say. "Maybe they react to movement. We are going to find out." "Could they become dangerous to us?" Eve asks. I take another look at the pseudo-blossom she gave me. "No, we are definitely too large for their digestive holes," I reply. "They seem to be passive hunters. They offer themselves to their prey, but they rely on their deception going undiscovered until it is too late." "In that case, there must be real blossoms somewhere," Eve says. "That's great news. I was so looking forward to picking flowers." Even though we have not found the original specimen that these hunting plants imitate, there is some reason to believe in Eve's theory. "Now, let us get out of the shadow of the mountain range," I say. Adam is already 500 meters ahead of us. He walks at a good pace and does not turn around. The closer we get to the light, the larger the percentage of leafy plants becomes. I stop and try very carefully to dig a specimen out of the ground. The root does not reach down very far into the crumbly soil, which smells like swamp, but it branches out considerably. I follow several strands until they merge again with others. So these do not appear to be individual plants at all. Here we have an entire colony that is connected through the soil and shares a root system. "It's just as you suspected with the hair plants," I say to Eve. "That's a clever strategy," she concludes. "If nutrients are lacking in one area, they can get them from elsewhere." I look at one of the hair plants for the sake of comparison. Here, similar to the specimens in the desert, each hair seems to end in a single tuber. Could all leafy plants on the planet be part of a single individual? After walking another 300 meters, we reach a strip approximately 3 meters wide, where only the hair plants grow. They are especially tall here, or one might assume this to be a deliberately constructed path. I examine the ground to find evidence for it. However, the soil here is not harder than elsewhere. The uppermost layer is visibly gray, but that could be caused by the stronger evaporation. I measure the mineral content of the strip and am surprised. The level of sodium, potassium, and magnesium salts is so high that certainly no terrestrial plant could grow here. Did someone poison the soil to keep it free of leafy plants? I want to know how straight this path is, so I decide to follow it. Its trajectory does not aim directly at the edge of the shadow, but approaches it at an angle. I contact Adam via radio. He grumbles a bit, but then changes his direction and now walks parallel to the path. Eve follows me without being asked. For a while, the path is so straight, I really believe it was deliberately planned. But then it suddenly forks. In the middle, there is an island about 5 meters wide covered by the leafy plants, with the two subsidiary paths running around it. I have a suspicion. First, I dig out a plant from the island, then another one from outside the right edge of the path. I compare both with the specimen I picked up earlier. The result is surprising. We seem to be witnessing a war of the plants, which use chemical weapons to take territory from their adversaries. While the three specimens do look similar externally, there are clear genetic differences. To test this, I dig a few feet deep into the path and discover the root systems of the leafy plants are not connected beneath the path. The entity forming the small island appears to be doomed, as it is threatened by two much larger entities to the west and east. The path seems to be something like a line of demarcation. The leaves of the outermost specimens in the west are infused with sodium and potassium compounds, while those of the east with magnesium. The rain then washes these compounds out as salt, so that the area between them becomes a barren battle zone. Only the hair plants seem to profit from this. It is reassuring to think that humans are not the only species in the universe waging war against its own members. I explain my findings to Adam and Eve.
"That's somehow interesting," Adam says. "But is it useful for us? Does it help us to know this?"
"Perhaps it will help us to fulfill the mission," I suggest.
"I couldn't care less about that.
We know what these plants are allergic to. We could use that when we build our own base in order to keep the area free of plants."
"That's what I meant," Adam says. "Perhaps you could focus more on practical knowledge like this instead of on theory. We have to hold out here for many years."
I'd better stop talking now. Another 15 minutes to the edge of the shadow zone, then it will be time for the next night. Almost 500 kilometers lie before us, and here in the open steppe, we won't find any protection against the flares of Proxima Centauri.